So, how do you like the big city?
New York, I'm talking about.
Yes. Well, I'm almost afraid to look around because I'm afraid it would spoil my memories.
You spent a lot of time here, didn't you?
I lived here about 16 years.
Yeah. Tell me
between
about that.
16 and 20.
Yeah, I was reading some biographical material here, and it says that after your graduation from Reed College, let's see, where does it say here?
I lived in New York for the winter of 1938-39, doing odd jobs mostly. Part of it was working on a bibliography of Aldous Huxley. And then I moved to Buffalo for 4 years, and after that I came back in the middle of the war in 1943, when New York was still having a depression. You could get cheap rooms and cheap food, and it, of course, the streets were all blacked out at night. You could see the moonlight.
That was what year? That was
43, 44.
It's hard to imagine. I grew up in Ohio, and I was reasonably young at that time, but when we had blackouts, it didn't seem to matter very much because sprawling suburban areas, small town Ohio, but I can't imagine New York being blacked out.
Well, it was.
How do we enforce that? I mean, we should have air raid wardens come around with their tin hats.
I came out of the subway at Times Square one night, and I couldn't get my bearings. Everything was completely black.
Well, that's just impossible to imagine, isn't it? I guess it was good practice, though, but I remember my family moved to Texas, and we used to go to the beach at Galveston, and I remember the big gun emplacements, which are still there, in these big bunkers, because they were expecting Nazi submarines to attack.
Well, that wasn't the reason New York was blacked out. New York was blacked out because there were convoys of troop ships leaving New York Harbor regularly. Mm-hmm. And they were silhouetted against the lights of New York, way out to sea. And so the blackout was to give the troop ships cover.
Well, Mary Barnard, is it Barnard or Barnard?
I pronounce it Barnard.
Barnard. Why did you decide to become a poet?
I didn't decide. I just was one from the age of 7.
You remember your first poetry?
A few lines about a robin when I was about 7.
Mm-hmm.
And I always knew from the time I started to read that I wanted to be a writer. I didn't mean to be a poet, especially. I think I thought more in terms of fiction, but I just spontaneously wrote more poetry than anything else, and when later I tried to write fiction, I found I wasn't very successful at it. I do better with poetry.
But James Laughlin must have liked your work in the 1930s, didn't he?
Well, enough to publish it.
Yeah.
Although I wasn't what he called wild and woolsey enough to become part of the New Direction stable.
That's right. He always looked for very experimental work.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What have been the general themes of your work over the years?
Well, the early poetry, of course, was very much influenced by my growing up in the Pacific Northwest. Along the Columbia River, so that there there's a great deal of imagery drawn from mountains and waterfalls and rivers and rocky seacoast, so on. But then I became interested, after I translated Sappho, I became interested in mythology and in the mythology and folklore of time. And this new book is I would say it's devoted to different aspects of time, the way we measure it, and the way we celebrate its passage, and the way folklore and mythology are associated with the measurement and with the celebration.
Well, Mary Bernard, just hang on one moment so we can sort of group this chat chronologically. Let's go back a little ways. Even before you were published by New Directions, according to the material I've read here, you sent, I guess, what amounts to a fan letter to Ezra Pound.
No, it was not a fan letter. It was a plea for help, plain and simple. And I sent 6 poems. And I was living at this time in Vancouver, Washington. I had just graduated from Reed College. It was the very depths of the Depression. I'd never met a poet. I had no hopes of meeting a poet. I sent poems out and got them back and sent them out and got them back. And finally I decided that I needed help. And I wrote to Pound partly because I respected his technical excellence more than, and I thought he knew more about writing poetry than anybody, far as the craftsmanship went.
Where was Pound living at the time?
He was living in Italy. And also, I knew he had helped other people, and the fact that the other people were James Joyce and T.S. Eliot didn't faze me much. I just thought, he does help people. And so I wrote to him and sent the poems and asked him for advice or assistance and pointed out how unlikely I was to find anybody else to help me. And he took me on and introduced my work to Lachlan and told me to write to William Carlos Williams and to Marianne Moore, and I kept up a friendly relationship with them for the rest of their lives.
Through the mails?
Well, no, when I lived in New York, I used to see Williams and Marianne Moore rather frequently.
What sort of atmosphere was it, intellectual and literary atmosphere, during that period when Moore was alive and Williams was alive and you were living here?
Well, of course, it changed. We talk about the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s, and certainly the 30s, and the 40s, and the 50s all had their own atmosphere. In the 30s, everything was political. Most of the poets were writing for publication in the New Masses or some other magazine, well, The Nation, The New Republic, and so on, and they were writing about Spain and that sort of thing. And in the 40s, of course, the tone changed, and there were more poems, and there were fewer poets in New York, I might add. Because they were mostly in the army. And in the 50s, there was another shift. Of course, one shift was that in the 30s, almost nobody had heard of William Carlos Williams. He had never published a book that he had paid for himself, except one that Pound got published in London. Marianne Moore was really better known because she had been editor of the Dial.
Yeah, that was a famous literary magazine, wasn't it?
Yes.
Long gone, though, I guess.
It died about the time I graduated from college. Mm-hmm. A Hound and Horn took over, more or less.
You published how many volumes of poetry up to this point? Approximately?
Well, I published my first collection in an anthology containing, published by New Directions. There were five young American poets, and there were collections of about 30 poems by each of the five. John Berryman was in it, and Randall Jarrell was in it. And
you were in good company.
I was in good company. And the then I didn't publish any more lyrics except for a small privately published volume for some time, but I did a translation of Sappho that was published by University of California Press in 1958, and that is still in print, and the sales increase a little bit almost every year, so that it sells about 4,000 a year now.
So Time and the White Tigress is your first book in
many years? No, then I bought out a volume of my collected poems in 1979. Mm-hmm. In between, I did a volume of essays on mythology in 1966. And I bought out a volume of essays on mythology in 66. I bought out my collected poems in 1979. And then an autobiography, Assault on Mount Helicon, a literary memoir in 1984. And then this is the first long poem I've ever done.
Well, it certainly reflects your interest in mythology and astronomy. And tell me why you have this, I don't know if it's an obsession or not, but it must be a passion at least.
With mythology or with time?
Well, here I think you've incorporated the two, haven't you?
Yes. And the reason, if it's an obsession, the reason it has become an obsession is that I find so few people who make that relation.
Well, what is the relation between mythology and time?
Well, mythology, of course, is related to religion, generally speaking. Religions usually have religious festivals. Religious festivals usually take place at stated times of the month or the year. And those times have to be determined astronomically. Unless you simply go by the first laid egg of the bluebird or something like that. They're just usually, in all parts of the world, they are determined by a new moon or a full moon in conjunction with a certain constellation. And at a certain, or by a solstice point when the sun reaches the winter solstice or the summer solstice. And the doing all this, the working out, the way to measure, the measurements, the constellations used, and the different appearances of the sun and moon, work their way into festival rites and into the folklore.
Well, you've broken this down and by using a term that I guess I wasn't familiar with. It's called FITT, but it's spelled F-Y-T-T-E, which is, I guess, a portion of a poem, right?
Yes, it is a section of a poem. The way it Now, in the first place, I wanted to avoid the use of the word cantos because I have been known as influenced by Pound, and too many people influenced by Pound have already bought out volumes of cantos, and I was determined I was not going to bring out a poem divided into cantos. And I remembered I'd been reading Lord Byron's letters, and in one of them he wrote a letter to his publisher saying that he would be sending him under separate cover Harold's latest fit, referring to the one canto, the last written canto of his poem, Child Harold. And that reminded me that the word fit means really the same thing as canto. It's archaic, but why not resurrect it? So I did.
Yeah, I wasn't familiar with it at all. I had to look it up.
Well, I put it in the front of the book.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, you, so you did. And I was also afraid I was going to mispronounce it by saying fight, but the dictionary told me it was fit.
Yes.
Now, you have some diagrams and figures. Now, what are the significance of these diagrams in your notes?
They're supposed to make the poem easier to understand for people who are likely to panic at the sight of a word like ecliptic. There is almost nothing...
I think I'm more likely to panic at the sight of a diagram like this.
Yes, perhaps, but, you know, there's almost nothing in it that Dante couldn't have assumed that his audience would be able to follow perfectly well, and the same for Milton. But now we have two cultures, and the poets look at it and say, oh, no, my mind goes blank if anything looks like a geometry problem. Or they come to a word like ecliptic and they say, but I never took a science course.
Are you a believer in these astronomical signs and what they...
Well, now, are we talking about astronomy or astrology?
Well, I guess we're talking about both in a way. I think you kind of combined them in a way, haven't you?
No, those are astronomical signs. They have nothing to do with astrology.
That's good. That's good. Well, I've always been skeptical of it. But when you're dealing with poetry or dealing with fiction and thought and so forth, it's interesting to interweave.
When I have tried to find an astronomer to talk to me about some of my problems... My first problem with them is that they think because I'm a poet, I must be interested in astrology. Also, because I'm an old lady, I must be interested in astrology. And it takes a while to disabuse them of that idea. Astrology and astronomy are not the same things.
Well, Mary Barnard, the book won the Western States Book Award for Poetry. Tell me just briefly, what is the Western States Book Award?
Well, it's awarded by a foundation called the Western States Arts Foundation, which is funded by Xerox and B. Dalton. And it's to promote letters out there, not only beyond the Hudson, but beyond the Rockies. I think it's the Rocky Mountain states in the West, isn't it? Are included in this, and they give for three awards a year, and they gave an honorable mention this year in addition, one for poetry, one for fiction. Clarence Major won that one for creative nonfiction. Anita Sullivan won that with a delightful little book on piano tuning, and Kim Stafford of Portland won the Audible Mansion or some... It's a book of sketches, I should think.
Well, Mary Barnard, congratulations to you. This is a lovely little book and beautifully illustrated. Pictures are delightful. And I hope that you enjoy your stay here in New York and that you go out and buy yourself some comfortable shoes tomorrow. Thank you very much.
Okay.